Welcome. This is Ed Philbrick with Kurt Stockton. This is episode 11 of the Service Course Report. We're recording on October 30th, the day before Halloween. And it's just the two of us today. Hopefully, we'll get Darren to join us for a little additional content, but it might just be the two of us. We're on Apple Podcasts. We're on YouTube video-wise, and we can also watch us video-wise on Spotify. And then available on Amazon Podcasts for audio as well. So, Kurt, how would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, first, I would also say that today is the 30th, the day before Halloween. It is actually Darren's birthday today, too.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's not why he's not with us at the moment. But, yeah, just got to give a little shout out to my younger brother. So, yeah, me, you know. Well, this episode is mostly a bovine recap for us. I say we talked about a little bit last episode. We started riding road bikes, you know, racing in 82. And before that, we were riding road bikes. And that's about when we started riding this thing that's called gravel now. You know, shortly thereafter, we were exploring on our bikes, over 45 years in the bike industry as well. So working, riding, running teams, marketing, putting on events, and mostly now attending events. We got to attend a good one this past weekend, the Bovine Classic in Atascadero, their fourth annual, my second, yours, a first time there. And, you know, Ed and myself, we took in the entire experience. We got in two shakeout rides. We hung out at Firestone Walker Tap Room on that Thursday, and then the bigger ride on the Friday, which was pretty crazy. It's that ride. Well, let's go. I mean, let's start. We met on Thursday at the Firestone Walker Tap Room in Paso Robles, so just north of Atascadero, for a early afternoon Thursday ride. There was what, 75 people more or less? It was pretty amazing attendance for the day of the week and the time of the day, I would say.
Yeah, it's amazing to pull up to a bike event now or a shakeout ride. And first of all, the vehicles are mind blowing nowadays. It's, you know, 25% vans. And the other thing that's always remarkable about a cycling event or a shakeout ride is how early people arrive. People are there 2 hours before, you know, and which is great. That's a good thing about cyclists, is they're there to really prepare themselves and get ready.
All right, just got oranged out there. Hang on a second. Yeah, it was. What's I always say, if you are, you mentioned that about the vans, if you are ever like in the market to buy a sprinter type van, sprinter or transit, I think one of the best places to go is to a cycling event. Just it's like better than a showroom or a lot, you know. Yeah, a lot of vehicles, a lot of people showed up. It was great. We did roll out on time. I thought it was fun. It was fun, you and I being ride leaders on a route we'd never ridden before, but it all worked out. I mean, it was fairly simple in that the organizer, Brian Yates, we had great files that we could put on our head units, and the ride was out and back, so it wasn't too difficult to figure it out. But that was a good one. The weather was really nice, and then we finished up right back at the Firestone Walker Tap Room there, and that worked out. They have actually a pretty good restaurant. We got to hang out. We heard a lot of stories. I think we heard more stories than we were involved with, so to speak, or telling there on that Thursday. But it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear how often cyclocross was a reason for them being here as a rider, or being there on that particular day. You know, people, cyclocross had evolved for them, and they were still racing cyclocross, but they were there to do a gravel event. It was a pretty common theme of the dinner table that we had. The other thing that I thought about a little bit was how amazing the riding was. You know, in San Diego, we have very few shaded canyons, but we went up a shaded canyon on a dirt climb. it was spectacular. A little bit of fall color. The poison oak was already turning color, and it was great riding, and not too many cars.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was pretty phenomenal. It was a little bit on the route itself. So just to give people an idea who didn't make it, or maybe they made it to the ride but didn't get to the shakeout ride. So this was the Friday shakeout ride. So that we, you know, this was most of the people that were there that jumped in for the photo before we left. So we're right in front of City Hall there. That was a Friday at, I believe we departed at 11 a.m. So quite a good turnout, you know, and a nice mix of NorCal and SoCal people. So that was pretty phenomenal. I mean, you look at the sky, the building there, City Hall, which is pretty spectacular. Yeah, it was pretty sweet. And that ride, again, that one went well. I think we had a good group of people. Sometimes it's challenging to keep a bunch of people that are at a race in check, but I thought we did a fairly good job of that. It was good.
You know, there was a couple of funny moments. One, we encountered the road grader. They were grading a gravel road. So that's kind of an interesting experience, more of a Midwest experience to encounter the road grader. We also had a quick reroute somewhere. We hit a dead end or a lock gate or something. And the other thing I was thinking about when I look at this picture is how amazing the city of Atascadero was to embrace us. I mean, there's not a lot of retailers that were impacted around the sunken gardens there. Coffee shop probably had an all time weekend with cycling espresso consumption. But it was mostly doctor's office, insurance brokers, not weekend businesses. So we all grew up with grumpy merchants upset about the closing of State Street. You know, the Santa Barbara Grand Prix was probably an inspiration for a lot of us racing bicycles in the area. And there was a lot of upset merchants. And here, you know, I don't feel like the merchants were impacted. And in fact, they probably benefited from us. So,
yeah. And that's just, and it's so crazy, right? Just by virtue of which merchants are on that kind of circle around the city hall. So yeah, that's a great point, because all the other ones were just off of that, off of the park. And, you know, we patronized a few of them. I know we got burgers in one place and coffee in another. So yeah, a lot of different ones. So that was pretty cool. Yeah. So, and then as far as, right. So we did two shakeout rides. And then of course we had the, day of ride and then everything we did there. So I would say kind of, you know, for me, like the weeks that were, right. So what did we ride? Well, we rode two shakeout rides plus the bovine. One of the coolest things, that I got to do, and you guys got to meet Gary, is this guy right here. So Gary Summers, the guy with the orange glasses, closer, yours truly in the background. We met at the Olympic Training Center when we were juniors. I think it was in 1983. We were roommates there for a junior camp. Gary from New York, Kurt from California. We got put in the same room, and we actually, you know, we raced as juniors for quite a while, and then into the senior ranks. And then when I got into mountain biking, guess who was also racing mountain biking? Gary was there. He did some racing for Otis Guy. You know, when I quote dabbled in the cross country before I went into racing downhill. And it's just this friendship. You know, I see him every once in a while. Last time I saw him and hung out was almost 10 years ago at the Crusher and the Tusher out there in Utah, the day that I got crushed by a bike ride. But it ended up being, you know, Gary and the three of us riding back. We were, I guess for lack of a better term, at the kind of the pointy end of the happy bovine, the short route, because we wanted to get back. But it was great riding with him, and he was one of those guys, you know, who was able to... We rolled through very well with each other because we've all been riding bikes for so long. That was, that was really pretty cool.
Well, the rolling through was hilarious. I'll tell you a little side story. You know, Keeping up with you guys was my maximum effort. And you guys waited for me twice, the top of the long segment, which was a pretty long climb. And then we got dropped on the flats, which I don't like to admit that I got dropped on the flats, but it was maybe a false flat. But anyway, there was one other time where I knew that Gary knew how to ride a pace line and had skills, because I had left like a little gap and he moved over on me and I let him move over, you know? Mm-hmm. And so a little bit later on, he realized that he'd done that to me. And so he just gave me a big old fat push to push me back on the back of your wheel. And so we had a little side chuckles behind you guys. So it was fun. And I told him, hey, you know, if I'm leaving a gap like that, you just move on over and I'll be okay. So he was fun to ride with.
Yeah, it was good. And he sent me these photos after the fact, I think on the next day. Yeah, and I would say then this one here, talking about kind of highlights, yeah, the riding was fun, but I also ended up getting to MC the awards with Mike Hecker, who was the announcer for the weekend. So I think you shot this one. That's Mike with his back to us and me there. That was actually pretty cool. It kind of blows me away how a guy like that, he started talking at 7 a.m. We didn't start the awards till 4:30 p.m. I mean, he did. I asked him about it. He's like, well, Chaos, he goes, I did take a break for breakfast, you know, and he said he had about a 3-hour break. But still, like, to be on like that all day, it was pretty impressive doing that. So that was a lot of fun. I'd never, you know, like I said, he was probably 13 when we met and started riding bikes, and he's making quite a career out of it for himself doing race announcing. So it was cool to be at an event where he was emceeing and then actually get to go back and forth a little bit. And it's always fun. I've done the podium. I've called the podiums for the Grasshopper Adventure Series for a couple years now. So I did see some familiar faces from up north that were on the podium this year at the Bovine. And you had mentioned, you know, it was segments. They did go to that segment format this year, which just, it works great. You've put an interview up that we did with Brian Yates. You know, he switched to that format, which allows us to be more social. You know, people actually go and they talk when they're riding rather than trying to race. They will stop at the aid stations and set their bike down and hang out for a little bit versus like fill their bottle and grab a gel and run off because they want to get the best time. So I think that enduro or segment format, you know, that was an idea of Joe Parkins. He brought up to when Grinduro started. A lot of people don't know that. I mean, it comes from enduro motorcycle racing, but it's a very cool format. It allows big groups of people can ride, you know, ride together. You bring a big group of people, you can ride together. You get to the segment, everyone goes as hard as they want to, and then you can regroup afterwards. So I think it's kind of a best of both worlds type of thing as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Your take. Have you done any segment events before?
There are segments in BWR, but I never pay attention because they're mostly for the pros, you know?
Yeah.
It's never really the primary focus. I can't think with just BWR where there's King of the Hill, King of the Mountain, King of the Sprint, different categories. I can't think. Oh, one time also a Michael Marks production, Creative Disruptions is his company. He did a Sagan Fonda with segments, but you know, I never paid attention to him.
Yeah.
Honestly, this weekend I didn't either. You guys stopped to for a nature break and I rode slow and took my jacket off and used it as time to recompose and take my arm warmers off and stuff. So I didn't pay attention to it. I think you were like 17th in the segment, and I was probably 22nd in the segment overall for the Happy Bovine, which is entertaining, but anyway.
Entertaining. Well, anytime there's a segment that's uphill and it's like for like 15 minutes, it kind of knocks us out of contention. I did do Grinduro California a couple of times, and it had a climb, and then it had a fire road descent, was the second segment. The third segment was a road section that was slightly false flat uphill the entire way. So everyone kind of hung out at the timing mat till a big enough group would go. And then the fourth one was a single track descent. So definitely more for mountain biking. But it, you know, it was fun, you know, and we had a good time. We broadcast from there. You know, this is a little shot of DS and myself in our service course report bovine tent there. So we did have the setup and had that going. We did some interviewing and we got to interview as well. So that was a good time. Yeah. See if I got, yeah. And this was one that was pretty cool. So that guy right there, you know who he is, but for people that don't, Clark Natwick, I believe 5-time national cyclocross champion. That was back in the 70s and the 80s. Like when we first started racing, this guy was a hero, you know, and in Northern California, I always remembered, and I think we spoke about this a little bit, it always seemed like the best cross racers came from NorCal when we were in California. They're in like the mid-Atlantic and the Northeast. And then, of course, the guys from Colorado would say Colorado. But if I recall correctly, cyclocross had a really great group of people from Northern California. I mean, and there are series like the Surf City Cyclocross is still going on in Santa Cruz there. And Clark was one of these guys before his time. And I got to reconnect with him earlier this year. He was riding the Grasshopper series. And I was like, oh man, that looks like Clark. I go, yeah. And like, what's up? And he goes, oh, you know, I started riding again. I'm loving it. And I guess he's friends with Chris Carmichael. And Carmichael got him an entry into SBT Gravel. So Clark was kind of training to go out to Steamboat. And I guess he's kept the steam going, you know, riding all the way into October. And he had a whole group of people from, you know, he's got the Penn Velo jersey on from down in the peninsula. There were a whole group of guys there. For another pod, I have photos of all of them taking their own podium photos up on the Bovine podium. So just, yeah,
they took it with this most amazing camera. It's a Rolleiflex. It's a roll, sometimes called a Rolly. And it's like one of those like cameras that you look down in it. I can't wait to see the film version of that photo.
Yeah.
A timer. So they were like looking down and then they were running up like old school.
Yeah.
And Otis Guy was in that photo with those guys. We have those photos. We'll share them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Only so much, so much for today. So yeah, but my overall take is just that it was just a great event. Like just so many smiling people. Like I felt like all I saw was smiling faces. Even the suffering faces were smiling. The venue, the gardens there. I mean, green lush grass in Central California is a pretty rare thing, you know, with the drought and all that we have. And it's just a magical venue that we're able to use there. So quite a bit of fun.
So did Clark Natwick also race on the road with Veltec Boyer? Is that what I remember?
You know, I think actually you're right. I mean, now that I go back to that, right, in those Veltec Boyer days when Jock was racing domestically, like in the mid-80s, and Gavin Chilcott, when we would always come up north, and that's when we'd see those guys, yeah. Right? They had that jersey. It was like yellow, and it had some blue stars on it, I think. That was when Veltec Sports had, I think they were an importer Santa Cruz area or Sand City or something, right?
They were the exclusive and maybe original importer of CD shoes to the United States.
Right, right. That's right. Yeah. Well, and that was, you know, there was that whole connection with the guy that ran the PDM team too, right? Right. Yeah. Concord Bikes. Wow. I know. It keeps coming back. We'll keep finding like more images of these things and what's going on. But yeah, it was a lot of fun for sure. There we go. Stop that. Well, and so the service course report, as we are, and you can just see the corner of your microphone in that image. We actually got ourselves, right? Our first official service course report swag. We have some stickers, people. So a few of these, we didn't manage to give them all away, but we did get some out at the event. And yeah, I guess we're official because we do have stickers now, right? So, yeah. Oh, yes. And the mugs. I did find mugs. Yes. Ed's got Ed's. Got that right there. We got our initials or names on them just so you know. They don't get mixed up, and DS has his, so a lot of fun. So I would say I would call this event, you know, most people, like, you put numbers on people and tell them it's a ride, they still race each other. You could tell by the excitement of people that got up on the podium that they did enjoy what they're doing. But there's a kid you've been watching on the racing front that's he's definitely, like, he would be the type that would do the 100-mile ride and be at the front the entire time, not segments, like a true racer. Tell us a little bit about this Jonas Woodruff.
Yeah, he caught my eye at the Quick and Dirty Summer Series on Thursday nights. I think he was racing against Matt Beers right before BWR. And I go, ooh, that kid looks impressive. And then he finished fourth or fifth in BWR California. He was with the elite riders. He was with Pete Stetna, Matt Beers, and Vermeulen, which that's a pretty elite selection to make deep into BWR California at, you know, the 110-mile mark at 19 years of age. And, you know, I think other people have had their eye on him for a long time. He's been racing Nika. He's from probably Redlands, California. But he just won the Quick and Dirty Filthy 50 this weekend.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah. he was in a four-man sprint, and he beat Lance Adette at the line. Lance was second. And so he's been doing well. He did top 15 at Big Sugar. That's a Lifetime Grand Prix race. And he was second in the U23 Lifetime Grand Prix this year. So he's just a rider to keep an eye on. He's a true bike racer. He's also extremely good at social media. You should watch his manual wheelies in downtown LA. He also went to the iconic skateboarding location in Encinitas, which is Encinitas City Hall. There's this big concrete wave, if you will, and he rode his road bike off of it. I think he's at, you know, actually, I want to tell you, he's at, well, it's been liked 8,000 times. That's just the likes. I don't know how many views. He was also at the front sitting on Matthew Vanderpool's ride in on the ponies ride in Griffith Park. So he knows how to play the social media game. He's up and coming. I told him he should go to Europe, but I think he likes the dirt here in the United States. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on him. And beating Lance in the sprint last weekend here in San Diego in Escondido was an impressive moment. And he's a true, real bike racer. And when you see that in somebody who's 19, you know, Greg LeMond was a real bike racer, Roy Nickman. There are certain types of athletes that show that they're racers at a very young age. And so it's cool to see.
You can just tell when you watch him pedal how he rides his bike, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's it, you know. And some people, if you've been around it long enough, you can pick that out. That's cool. I don't know that I've ever actually seen him, or if I have, I didn't realize it. So definitely, I'll keep a lookout on that as well. Yeah, pretty cool. Well, so we have our different segments here, and I think the first one we came up with was our amateur segment for these amateur moves. And I'd have to say that it became apparent pretty quickly at the Bovine that the amateur segment for this post-Bovine cast was all about me. And so it started out, so I finally got my new bike. I got a Mondraker Arid, the gravel frame, and I've had it for a few weeks, and I've been just so busy.
Tell us about Mondraker. Mondraker. I don't know that brand really.
You don't know that brand. So Mondraker is a Spanish brand, right? It's there's kind of two big Spanish brands. You've got Mondraker, and you have Orbea. And they're doing everything, or all their finishing, you know, big in-house production. The brand is owned by a guy that owns a distributor called Team Bike. So as a distributor, they are a high-end service center for a number of brands. I don't know if it's Fox or SRAM RockShox that they do. But they do, like there's these official service centers in different countries that will service bikes for that. And Darren's been a Mondraker dealer now for probably a little bit over a year, so he's had that arid. And as I was looking at it, because I've had some problems with the custom-made bikes, which I'll go into in the later pod. I've had some amazing titanium bikes built, and none of them were correct, 100% correct. And it's been pretty frustrating. It's been an interesting learning journey. But that Mondraker Arid was the closest bike I've ever seen to my custom geometry that's not a custom bike. I tend to ride a pretty long position, and the Mondraker has that very long center to front geometry, what mountain bikes have gone to over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, with a lot longer top tubes, and then you run a shorter stem. We like to, Darren and I call it the moto geometry or moto geo, similar to a motorcycle, right? Motorcycles don't have stems, they have triple clamps that hold the bars right on top of the forks. So that longer center to front, a high stack and a short stem. So I've ridden a 120 or a longer stem on all my bikes for as long as I can remember. This bike I've got set up with the 90 mm stem, which is like super stubby for me. And I actually had to, the 90 comes with their extra large frame. I got a size large frame, so I was like, hey, can I get a 90? I was able to get that, and it's, and the thing is, it's a bit of a proprietary shape stem on where it clamps to the steer and with their top caps, so it makes it all nice and clean with the spacers that they have for routing the brake lines, because everything is internal, and we'll get into that a little bit further on here. So I have not, so I took that bike down. Well, let me back up. So we did that first shakeout ride on that Thursday. I finished building my bike Wednesday evening. It was still light out, so it actually was late Wednesday afternoon. It wasn't fully Wednesday evening. And basically, I got it all together. I rode it up and down the street for a total of about 300 meters, and I packed it in the van. Not as an excuse, but just as a little reference point here, I did all of this in a fairly sleep deprived and time crunch state, which was my own doing and my first mistakes. But it's like, hey, it is what it is. And so within that, I had got some Enduro headset bearings, stainless bearings, the lifetime guarantee ones to replace the OE bearings that came with that bike. And I thought I had the correct one spec'd, but apparently I didn't. So when I initially put it together, I was getting a little binding on the headset. So I swapped the upper bearing and I thought that that had done it all. Well, it turns out that I learned later, I didn't triple check. I had the incorrect lower bearing. It wasn't deep enough. So when I rode my bike up and down the street, it was binding a little bit, and I'm like, oh, I'll get that adjusted. It was my mistake to not triple check everything, but again, a little sleep deprived, a little time crunched. You go with what you run what you brung. So I rode the Arid on that first shakeout ride, right? And there was no amount of wishing that everything would settle in that helped. And it was the headset was binding. It was sketchy. Couldn't take my hands off the handlebars. I'm like, all right. Well, luckily I brought everything with me too. I brought all the OE bearings, the other bearings I had, and not my first rodeo. I actually brought one of my other bikes with me just in case.
So
I
you had a
brought it.
mobile you had a mobile service course or
I had a
course.
mobile service course. Yeah, for the service course report. Exactly. So it was first ride on that bike, and it was actually the first trip in the van that I just got a few weeks ago. So at least I had plenty of room for everything. I didn't have to wedge it in, behind the seats in the wagon. So I was like, all right. So I brought everything to make the swap. right? So what is normally swapping a headset bearing is pretty simple process, except that all these bikes now run their brake lines internally through the steer, through the head tube, and they pop out the top of the top cap. So that means to make a simple swap of a headset bearing, you have to unwrap your handlebars. I run these gel pads underneath my handlebar tape for a little extra cush. Take off the gel pads. Then all the electrical tape that holds the brake lines in place, right? And I run SRAM wireless blips, so I had to take those off as well. And then detach the brake lines. Turns out all I had to do was swap the lower bearing. I'm like, okay, I got all together. It works. Had my bleed kit. Well, great. So I got to put it all back together. So I think I did all that Thursday evening. So I put it all back together, reconnected the brake lines, taped the brake lines to the handlebars, right? Positioned those gel pads and the blips, wrapped everything up. And I went to bleed the brakes and I couldn't push fluid through the system. And this was, I think at this point, you and Darren had gone down to the restaurant at the hotel. And I was like, just order me whatever you're ordering yourselves and let me know when the food's coming. So I got to the point where I couldn't push fluid. I'm like, this is a perfect time to stop because I'm like pretty frazzled. I'm like, oh, okay. So no big deal. Second bike, I'll ride that in the morning and then sort it out. So we did ride number two, rode my bike. It worked great. And then I just like, I'll deal with it. So I went to plan B. So my plan B was I'm going to go talk to a professional to get their opinion. Like, did I under torque? Did I over torque? Did I put the SRAM olives or directional? Did I put them on the wrong direction? I don't know. So turns out SRAM wasn't doing any technical service at this event. They were just expoing and talking with people. But fortunately, Mike's Bikes was there and they had their mobile service. So great. So my buddy Matt Whitler from SRAM, he went and connected me with Tamara from Mike's Bikes. Turns out she's like, oh yeah, I can totally do it. So I leave the bike with her and we were doing something and she comes back and she goes, I just picked this van up right before I came down here and there's no SRAM bleed kit in the van. So my plan B was to get that done. No SRAM bleed kit in the van. And one of my next mistakes, I didn't bring my bleed kit over from the hotel because I'm like, well, they're a mechanic. They're going to use their own tools. They don't need my tools to do this. So I'm like, all right, so now we're going to go to plan C because SRAM's not doing service. Matt Whitler, he gets in touch with Hector at SRAM to see if the local bike shop would perform the bleed. And now it was about 4:45. And they quickly got back to him and said, nope, we're closing. We can't do it. So I'm like, well, at least I have another bike. I should be good. Well, I was pretty much resigned to riding my other bike. And he goes, well, hang on, let me go talk to Doug. So Doug Dalton, known as Double D, we met back on the circuit in the 90s. He was there with SRAM. And he's like, oh, I want to introduce you to Doug. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, we've known each other for like 30 years almost. It was kind of funny. He was working wrenching for Cannondale and was a mechanic for the Sobey Headshock team. If you remember those Sobey South Beach beverages, it was like just another sweet canned beverages, but they were making a big push. Yeah. And so he agreed to work on my bike. He had his small travel tool kit, but he didn't have a bleed kit. So I'm like, all right, I'll go back to the hotel. He's like, we'll knock it out for you. No problem, chaos. So, and this is a long-winded story. Thanks for listening, everybody. So I'm like, all right, I'll go back and fetch that bleed kit from the hotel. And when I got back, Double D, he confirmed that I had under-torqued the connection at the lever. So that's why I wasn't pushing fluid through. So that was great. At least I didn't over-torque anything and damage it. And he had torqued everything to spec, and now it was working. We just needed to push a little fluid through it, be all good. And so I got back there, and Darren was there with him, and they were both marveling that, and they were surprised that I have my brakes hooked up moto style. So, you know, normally I ride a right rear, left front. They're like, you ride moto style, KS? You got your brakes hooked up moto style. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? They're like, yeah, you've got the right to the front and the left to the rear. I'm like, what? So I was so, when I connected my brakes in the hotel room, I had even run the tubing correctly out of the steer cap, and then it got crisscrossed. So I had hooked them up left to right and right to left. So they were backwards, right? So the first time I would have grabbed a handful of rear brake, I would have gone over the handlebars. So as it turns out, had Tamara had a bleed kit in the van, she would have bled my brakes and I would have been like, I would have got my bike all done and then they would have been backward. So finally got it all dialed, but it was pretty cool. So we have a kind of a sequence of images that just captured this, right? So this was one, I think you caught this one of me. Yeah. In the hotel room. Luckily, you can't see my face and the black circles under my eyes. But, you know, there's my workbench right there. I had to take the lampshade off the light to get a little room. I got multiple headset bearings, you know, got some tools, dealing with all this stuff. Yeah.
You're in the media center there where you're supposed to work on your laptop.
Yeah, you're supposed to be working on your laptop. But I brought a work stand. I had all this stuff. But then I went to the professionals, and so this is Doug Double D here, and he's working on my bike. So it was it may have been a first that I have had him work on my bike, but it was definitely the first time I have had anybody in a cow outfit working on my bike. So that's Hector there in his Moo outfit. So I had double SRAM tech working on the bike in the parking lot there. And it was great to do it because at the end of the day, these guys, and here's City Hall in the background. So we were in the parking lot just off stage left, I guess it would be. And those guys got the bike all dialed, got the brakes put in there. You know, teamwork. They were bleeding. They were putting stuff in. They were checking torque specifications. And I tell you, you know, And Double D was happy that he had these high-vis green gloves because it was the first time he got to use them. And if anyone's ever met him, you notice he's wearing flip-flops. I don't think I've ever seen this guy wear shoes. We'd see him at World Cup events. It would be raining sideways and snowy and muddy, and the guy always had sandals on. Some things never change. But very grateful that that these guys were able to get it all dialed in for me. So that's it. So I got the bike. I was able to get it all hooked up, and so really my first proper ride on the Mondraeger Arid was the Bovine Classic 2025. Rode through, we talked about the ride earlier, not a hitch. Nothing went wrong, everything worked perfectly. And now I'm just looking forward to getting out on some proper rides on the terrain that I know up here in Nevada City, and give a full evaluation on the bike and if I'm going to be able to stay with that stubby stem or if I'm going to have to maybe go, I have a 100 that might be a little bit better for what I'm doing. But we did do the ride and little post-ride photos. You can see on this one, I don't know how well y'all can see on the screen, but I mean, there's even, like we had a little fog in the morning, a little moisture, and it's like the front of my spokes even have a little bit of dust stuck to them. So the fork there, special edition service course bicycles. We all had them on our head tubes day of. This is the Mondraeger Unlimited. So they did a very limited run for 2026 of this paint scheme on this bike. And it's pretty cool. And there it is, a little side shot, you know. So some bike shots here. What else do we have? Yeah, so that was it. So I think I actually was able to cover Amateur and what went wrong in the same segment, because my what went wrong is like, what were you thinking? And I tell you, for you people at home, you kids at home, don't work on your bike when you're sleep deprived. Don't be time crunched, and always use a torque wrench. Those are my three lessons. I mean, it was you know, it was finally, I would say, Plan D or Plan Double D, which was that got my bike going. So, yeah, that was,
well, I think it's also important to point out that SRAM's wireless setup makes all this possible. I mean, you're not dealing with cable stretch or, you know, their wireless system sets up so quickly, and you were able to ride it and not have any kind of mechanical issues the next day, which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great point. And having ridden this, what they called ETAP initially, I don't know if it's still called ETAP, but all their wireless access now. Yeah. It does make that setup so easy. I mean, this new stuff, I've got that T-type derailleur on there. It's like you set your chain length, there are no limit screws on that derailleur, and you make adjustments with the app and you can micro adjust it and it goes. So, I've heard there are some patents out there for wireless braking. I don't want to be a beta tester for that. Yeah. Maybe they'll get the couplers so good that you can just pop those things apart not have to unwrap everything and do it. Because that's one of the things that, when all this internal routing came through, it's like, yeah, that's great when you have a full-time mechanic and you're on the world tour. So, but yeah, I was the amateur on this one. For sure. So that was,
you were also blinded by science a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be blinded by the, as far as that geo goes, but yeah, all the other stuff, it blinded me, but I shot back at it. And like I said, now just looking forward to getting out and riding the bike on some familiar terrain. Give a more of a long-term evaluation when I've had some time to get some hours on it.
That has to be the first time you've ridden the SRAM transmission derailleur.
No, I had it on my titanium bike. So I actually just took all the parts. So the last bike that I got was at the beginning of the year. I had it built for that type of derailleur. So I took, somewhat used parts. I haven't ridden a lot this year, but swapped everything over and put it on the Mondraker. It actually has a little bit shorter chain stays than the Thai bike I had, so I did shorten the chain a little bit, but still has great clearance with the seat stays and the whole back end they have on that. So I'm also looking forward to getting up and riding some of those larger volume tires that you and DS have been talking about.
Yeah, for sure. I rode 40 Panaracer, 40 Pathfinders, and I measured them when I got home. I wasn't even sure what they were, but they were totally fine. That's another nice thing about that event is it's not too arduous on the gravel, so you can just get away with a pretty simple bike. Unfortunately, I've noticed that I've frozen up here. Hopefully this all works later on. We'll have to find out. Back, we had some momentary tech glitches that meant we're recording part two, or do, with Darren instead of Kurt.
Yeah. All right.
We're following up on episode 11 in the Bovine Classic. So, DS, what were some of your takes from the weekend of the Bovine Classic, which was about a week ago?
Yeah, last weekend. Man, overall, that was just really a great event. One, I hadn't actually been off 101 and into downtown Atascadero. I calculated out in about 35 years. So obviously one would expect that it changed a lot since I raced the downtown Criterium. But it's really great, the downtown area. Good food and shops around. And the Sunken Gardens was just like an ideal venue for an event like that because it just seemed like it drew everybody in after the event to the same spot, whereas a lot of events afterwards, people are hanging out and it's a little, scattered around and people are here or there. That was one thing I really liked about it is everybody congregated into the Sunken Gardens. They had good food, good music to hang out. So that was a fun part of it. And just the overall ride was great. It's always fun, no matter how much you read about what product is the fastest and the best, of people posting, tech reports and things. It's always fun to actually get out to the events and see what all the people that are at the events are actually riding. Do they care or not? And so tires, bikes were, and I'm sure you guys talked about it, but this one was, a decent amount of pavement and the gravel's not too chunky. A lot of the gravel sections were things that I had ridden in the Eroica. I did that, ways back 6, 7, 8 years ago, 2 years of the Eroica. And so they used a lot of similar roads, even on the Happy that we did, the short one there. Our main climb was one that I remembered from that and a couple of different descents and a couple of the different sections, but you know, it's mostly pretty smooth gravel, not too crazy. So I know the what did you think?
That's the most mild gravel event I've ever done. That's the most champagne-esque gravel
right.
I've ever ridden.
Yeah.
Event. I mean, no chunk, nothing, like it was totally mild and very accessible to anyone that wants to come do it.
Absolutely. You know, and I talked to Ryan Moore from the Lucky Llama afterwards and saw him at the coffee shop this week. And that's what he was saying too. I mean, they had obviously in the longer ones, they had some long climbs. There's one big long climb that they go over and some different stuff, but he confirmed the same thing that the gravel really wasn't too chunky out there. Pretty fast flowing gravel and the dirt was good. So that was nice. So the technical nature of it wasn't too big of a bar for people. It was definitely a smaller gravel tire course. I just left my 50s on there that I've been doing some testing on. I was definitely overtired for that event. Towards the end, my legs were overtired, but as far as my setup, I was overtired. I could have had, you know, probably 45s on there, or even 43s, and they would have been fine just because there was a lot of pavement. But yeah, and a lot of some of the wineries that we stopped through where the aid stations were in, those were ones that I had seen in the Eroica also. So that was just cool. I had a little bit of familiarity, great rest stops. And I really liked the segment style of how they did it for people to get awards. You know, there was the overall ride, but there were no awards for your overall time. They just took certain segments and then they added up those segments to give you your segment times. And that's what people's results were based on. And I think that that's a really great way to do it because it gives people the chance to go hard, but then also gives people the chance to regroup and hang out. You know, like you could go hard through the whole segment, get your time in, and then wait up for your friends and enjoy a rest stop where you don't feel like everybody's, you know, dashing in and out of there to take off and get ahead of you on the road. So I think it brings a more social aspect to it. If you remember, Ed, when we were coming into the first section, we didn't realize we saw that big or first segment and we saw a big group stopped up ahead and you and Kurt and I are like, oh, great, we're going to be able to, you know, get in this group and get some draft. And then they took off what maybe 30 or 45 seconds ahead of us and they were gone because that was the start of the segment. They were all pinning it, you know, so we caught a few of them, but a lot of them were up ahead. But I like that style for an event like this. I thought it was great. What did you think about the segment situation?
I agree. I concur with your assessment. I didn't see a sign for the first one. I did see the sensor in the road, so I knew we were, I assumed, starting it. I didn't really care. And I guess I saw the sensor when we were done, but I think they were missing a little signage or it didn't catch my eye. I'm pretty good at catching all the signs, but I didn't see the start. And we only had one segment, and I was in the previous part with Chaos. I was talking about how you guys stopped for a nature break, and I slowed down and took my jacket and arm warmers off. So we didn't take it too seriously. I think we were 17th and 21st overall in the segment. So in the happy section.
Yeah, in the happy segment.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was a hard climb, and thankfully you guys waited for me at the top. Otherwise, I would have been alone from there because it was quite a climb.
Yeah, that's a pretty decent climb. Yeah, I was trying to hold my nature break until we got through the segment. But you know how when you got to go to the bathroom worse and worse, it feels like the nose of your saddle is just slowly tilting up and up and up. And finally, I'm like, all right, I just got to stop here on the side. I thought it was funny, the one female who was in, I think she was in the middle distance event. I can't remember her name that Kurt knew from some events. And she came up to him afterwards and she's like, I don't know if you talked about that, but she's like, oh man, Kurt, that was a baller move, pulling over in the middle of the segment, just like you didn't care. And she thought it was like a power play, but Kurt was really just, you know, how to do a nature break like myself. So I thought that was pretty funny, but it was great. I mean, the weather was great. It was a fun rollout. You know, we took off and the three events, you know, three distance, they lined up the longest event first, you know, the middle event, and then the happy, we were at the back. And then on top of that, Ed, you and I were getting some media, you know, for the Bovine Classic at the start. So by the time it rolled through, we were at the very back of, you know, 600 plus people. So KS, some old racing DNA, and KS kicked in and he got us on his wheel and he was like zipping around the field and skirting right on the center line and going up. So that was actually kind of fun and spicy to follow that and get up to the front and get into, you know, maybe some of the middle groups where we could get a draft with them. But all of it, you know, the course was great. There was nothing really seemed really sketchy or dangerous. You know, for the most part, the turns were pretty well marked. They had officers at any of the dangerous ones. And overall, I thought it was, you know, I thought that part of it was great. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was talking with KS about the amount of moto. So I think the rolling closure concept, when you and I were racing growing up, we never really pondered this whole rolling closure thing. I think a lot of the times the roads were truly closed. But in the modern world, and even in Europe, we have this whole rolling closure. And, you know, in BWR, they kind of have the motos at the front for the pros. And we had motos along the side of us in this event, like quite a few of them. And I thought it was good to keep you honest about the center line because you could hear the motos coming in, around. And they were mid-pack is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
There was a couple of moments where I had to work my way around the motos because the moto couldn't go fast at a moment when I needed him to go fast. So as we all know, motos with it mixed in the middle of the race is a very dangerous moment because of the varying speed. But the amount of road protection that they were providing rolling around us was great.
Yeah, I agree with that. Definitely some people aren't used to having motorcycles around and riding that close, but all the riders seemed experienced and they didn't seem like they were jamming themselves into, you know, areas that then the field would bunch around them. I mean, you know, really too much. Yeah, I thought it was great. They definitely had some people out there that have been riding, you know, riding bikes and doing that for a while. Yeah, so I thought that part was, I thought that part was fun.
So you've been in the area, you've ridden in the area, you went to Rock Cobbler, this is maybe like your second gravel-ish event, or maybe you've done five of them or so.
Right.
What were your takeaways on the equipment? Like, what struck you the most? I mean, you mentioned it a little bit, but you didn't see a lot of white tires.
No, definitely.
Suspension. What did you see?
Yeah, exactly. And this was definitely like a less chunky, a little more, the needle swing a little more towards the road side of gravel, you know, a little bit faster, definitely a lot more people out there on like fast gravel setups, tire wise, which I'm always interested in. Looked like, you know, 38s to 43s were probably 80% of people out there. Not too many, you know, fat tires, 50s like myself. Most people just on standard gravel bikes, not a lot of suspension, you know, few people on mountain bikes, maybe one or two Franken bikes out there, you know, mountain bikes with drop bars or something possibly, but mostly it was pretty standard gravel. And for a course like that, that's definitely, you know, if you had your choice of a bike, if that's what you were comfortable with riding, that's what you would want to get on. You know, I could, with our event, we had like, I guess there were in the rains that they had the week before, I understand they actually had to pull a little bit of the gravel out of the happy ours, you know, the 45 that we did. So we would have originally had a little bit more dirt, but they just didn't have the chance to tune it all up in time, you know, in time for us to make it. But definitely, I think ours was maybe 75% pavement, they said. And so, definitely my big 50s felt slow, you know, felt slow on the pavement. On the dirt, obviously, they were awesome, but on the pavement, it definitely felt slow. And, you know, what did you think? Cause you were running like 43s on your tire, on your rims, I think something around there, right? 42s, 43s, I think.
Yeah. No, when I got home, I finally calipered the tires. I had been ignoring my gravel bike since April. So I hadn't really pondered exactly what width tires they were. And one thing that a bone to pick with Specialized, they sure make it hard to read the sizing on the tire without your caliper.
So I calibered
them and they were like, they're 40s, but they're truly a 43 with a caliper.
Right. They measure 43.
That was totally fine. There was one descent where I felt like not enough tire was holding me back, but also just a little bit of fear. So you guys kind of gapped me a little on one descent when I felt like I didn't quite have big enough tires, but in general it was fine. And there was so much road and so much flat gravel that it was a perfect tire, to be honest.
Yeah, no, really. Like I said, if I could go back and just do it and would have had the time to switch out a no, I definitely would have put something a little bit smaller on. Because that one descent that I remember, and KS was at the front and he was going for it. And definitely laying it out there in between traffic. But that was the only kind of fast, you know, downhill sketchy part that had a little bit of, you know, somewhat loose dirt. But overall, yeah, I think the narrower tires were the way to go. You know, the one funny, there are a couple of funny things for me are just kind of like vignettes. But the one was probably in the last, you know, in the last 10 miles of our ride, there was this one section. So KS's buddy, and I can't remember his name, from Fairfax, ended up grouping up with us. So, you know, it was you, Kurt, and I, and I can't remember his name. We're all, you know, fairly equal legs, right? So we're all kind of rolling through and hitting it. And there's this one section at the end.
Gary Summerhill, I think, and Kurt talks about him in his episode or his portion of the episode.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was this, like I said, we're in the last 10 miles and we're on pavement. I think there was one other gravel section after that. And we're going along and the four of us are, you know, rotating through. Kurt happens to be at the front. I'm on his wheel. Gary and then you, I believe, is the order. And a couple guys that were probably doing the 65, I think it was two guys came by with the same like club jersey. And they were definitely on the aero, skinnier tire, fast gravel side of things. And they come ripping by. And as soon as I see him out of the corner of my eye, all I'm thinking is, KS, please don't jump on their wheel. You know, because I didn't want to go any harder than we were going. Of course, as soon as KS just cuts whiff of them off his left shoulder, he's up and sprinting rah, to get on their wheel. And I'm like, oh, crap. Okay, here we go. So we're going along and settling in. And it was a long, false flat up, probably about a mile. You could see all the way up ahead. And there were a few stair steps in it. And each stair step we hit, those two guys at the front didn't slow down. And so each stair step, you know, you have that realization that you're like, oh man, this is how hard I'm going to have to go to stay on the wheel. And, you know, I know KS's riding style pretty well. And he looked like he was holding the wheel. I'm going, oh man. So I'm trying to get a little more aero, trying to get out of the wind, pushing really hard on the pedals. The guys at the front, they're cranking it. They're going a little faster. Now I'm going, oh man, I don't think I'm going to be able to stay on KS's wheel. But then of course, pride sets in, right? Because I don't want to get dropped. So I'm just digging in going, oh man, you know, and at that moment I was trying to find a place of zen to get in my suffering. And I realized that in the normal riding I do, my gravel and mountain bike, I mostly don't have anybody that forces the pace on me, you know, other than say Jonah. But most of the hard parts of our riding is just dictated by the terrain. Like, can you make it up this climb? It's not like somebody hammering. And so that just made me laugh that I haven't been forced to stay on the wheel. So we're going. And there's this last kind of hard stair step at the end of the section. I'm going, oh man, I don't think I'm going to be able to stay on the wheel on this, but I'm going to do everything I can. And right as we kind of hit it up, I saw KS look over his shoulder once, I think a little bit before that. And then he just kind of eases off the guy's wheel in front of him and kind of shakes his head. And I'm like, phew, you know, like, all right. I said, oh yeah. And the guy right behind Gary, he goes, I'm good with that. I mean, like, you know, a half second later. So I think all of us were thinking the same thing, but didn't each want to say, hey, let's let those guys go. So they ended up riding away, and then we got our last rest stop at the library in there and got some food and then headed on into the finish. But that was a pretty funny part for me. But the quads were definitely feeling it, yeah, pushing hard.
I was like, they were going fast, and I was like, oh, I don't want to get dropped. You know, you never want to get dropped because it just makes life harder.
Right.
And I just pulled the plug on the falls flat. And then I'm so glad that you guys waited for me, because that was like the second time you waited for me. I was like, whew, that was a little fast. Cause I don't train like that, you know,
yeah,
like, or at those kind of speeds. So whenever they come around, I mean, last fall and winter I was, but I haven't in recent times. So I don't have that in me.
Yeah. That's like I was saying, it's that group riding thing where you're, yeah, that group riding dynamic where you're in and somebody forced it and you got to be able to wind it up and hit that higher pace. I definitely felt a little bit stuck in the mud, as the Irish used to say, you know, or as Alan McCormick would call, if your legs were hurting, two sticks of shite, I think was his terminology. Although my legs were okay, but in that moment, they weren't that great. Yeah. So, yeah, but
Sean
that was
Kelly and, the Sean Kelly and,
Sean Kelly.
Yeah, the Sean Kelly, Stephen Roach one where they ride up to each other and I'm feeling blocked. Eat some garlic. Yeah. How does that one go?
I can't remember that one, but they always seem to have like some old kind of like wives' tale, you know, remedies back in those days, different things, you know, what you should eat. Yeah, I'm blocked to have some garlic. Yeah, pretty funny. But no, overall, it was great. And then we got back, you know, early enough to kind of check the vibe of everybody coming in. And again, you know, it was a great atmosphere. The people that wanted to go fast could go fast, but there are a lot of people that just wanted to do the ride and be a part of it. And then again, coming back after finishing, everybody just congregated in the garden. And that was just like a great hangout. You know, there were all sorts of people. Bikes were, you know, in the racks. That's when I got to walk around and check out all the tires and what people were riding, just what bikes that people were riding in general. And so that was really cool. And that downtown area, I mean, there was a Amsterdam Coffee was like right on the corner of the Sunken Gardens. We got lunch on Friday after the shakeout ride at that one burger place. It was right there. And that's really easily inaccessible. Even in the morning, you know, we were able to go right over to that restaurant and I got us some breakfast burritos, you know, take out to eat for food. So everything was really close and easy right there. Sometimes you show up at an event and you're like, oh man, how can I get food or get over there by the start time? So from that side of it, the operational side of being a participant in it, I thought it was really simple and easy. You know, it's only a minute or two off the 101 right there, easy access. So all of that side was made the event just really a pleasure to do. You know, parking was good. Yeah, it was great.
When you and I were growing up, Paso Robles was just a fruit stand and a gas station. And,
yeah.
Then the wine business came to town. And now Templeton, which is between the two towns, Tascadero and Paso
right.
Robles, Templeton has a Trader Joe's. And
yeah.
I mean, it's obviously a place, part of the world where people who can't afford to live in San Luis Obispo or on the coast, or, you know, are setting up a pretty decent lifestyle for themselves. And it's an amazing area that's obviously changing and going to play a role in the future of Central California. So, and then the wine business just blows my mind. I you and I grew up with the very first wineries in the San Ynez Valley. Of course, Napa
yeah.
had its thing going on, but San Ynez Valley is new to wine.
Right.
And then this whole area is new to wine, and it is no longer just a fruit stand. So.
No, definitely. There was, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot out there, but really beautiful, like the event, you know, the course going out through the foothills and a lot of just houses with a little bit of space around them and little small ranchos and things like that. But you never, I don't know, it's rare that you can find a place where you feel like you're out enough, but not too far out. You know, like you're in the boondocks, things were pretty close. And yeah, I mean, as far as a place to be, it looked pretty nice. I mean, would be an amazing place probably to live. And if you're into the outdoors and the people generally around there, seemed pretty good vibes. I didn't get any snarky vibes from people. You know, sometimes if a town has a little small town vibe to it and you come in from out of town for an event, you can maybe get a little bit of a look from people. But I didn't get any of that at all. Everybody was, you know, was inviting and welcoming and seemed generally happy to see us. So good overall. Yeah.
Yeah. The Sunday morning after the event, is there anything more you wanted to mention about the event?
No, I think that was good. I wanted to hear a little bit more about I got a few photos texted from you of your adventures the next day. So I want to hear more about that.
Yeah. So Sunday morning I got up and I drove, I think it's Highway 41 from Tascadero. Maybe it's more from Paso Robles and it goes towards Cambria. Or Cayucas, maybe to be precise. And I got on that highway and I go, ooh, I've been here before. And I've been here before with Darren.
Yeah.
I go, this is like the climb that we did from Paso Robles Great Western Bike Rally when we were in middle school riding to the coast.
Yeah.
And I remember that climb at about 12 or 13 years of age. It was pretty significant at the beginning of those bike trips. You weren't
right.
totally fit yet, you know, but the end of the week or the end of the second week, you were in pretty good shape. But
right.
I kind of recall this long climb and then you get over the top and then you can actually see Hearst Castle like on the in San Simeon on top of the mountain,
yeah.
on the backside of Hearst Castle. And I remember us like climbing up that and I can remember Pike Riegert and being with a few other riders at the time, but you know, I go, I've been here before.
Yeah.
So
it is amazing how you can
I'm sure that Oroika,
Yeah. So the, yeah, the, I was going to say, yeah, it is amazing how you can, like, years later, I mean, that was obviously a lot of years later, but you can still remember certain climbs like that, or just remember the scenery, you know, it really sticks in. So it's funny that you remembered that, just like I could remember a couple of those gravel sections in the Bovine from the Eroica, although admittedly within 10 years ago, but 40 years ago, or however long, 42 or 3 years ago, that we were doing those middle school trips, that you could remember that. But absolutely, we did that. We did that section. So you went over 41.
Yeah. We rode from Paso Robles.
Yeah.
41.
Yeah. So you were saying right of the wheel.
So then I went down to Montaña de Oro, I went down to Montaña de Oro, south of Morro Bay. Actually, I ate on the pier in Morro Bay. There is such a thing as a pier, or sort of the boat fish unloading area there with the view of the rocks. I had ahi fish tacos, which was amazing, like looking at the giant rock.
Right.
And then I rode Montaña de Oro, which is spectacular riding.
Yeah.
I know that you've been there before yourself, and you and I had camped there in middle school, so I had to
Right.
go back. I was a little surprised how small the campground is, but
yeah.
It was spectacular riding.
Yeah, that whole trail network that they've built there at Montaña de Oro is incredible. And the trails are not too technical, so it makes for a real easy up on it, you know, and they're not too steep, so you can really ride up them pretty easy. And then they're, because they're not so steep coming down, they last a long time. They've got a lot of just like mild berms and things that you can go. So I was blown away by how great Montaña de Oro was riding. I want to go back up there again. I rode it just one, you know, I've ridden it one time with a friend of mine, but I want to go back and do like an overnight ride, sleep out, ride the next day, and then head home, because there's definitely a lot there. I mean, you could really ride all of that on a gravel bike too. There wasn't that much that was too chunky, you know, at least of the trails that I tried out.
No, you certainly could gravel it there. And you would want to camp and or stay in a hotel and do two days of riding for sure. The surf was huge when I was there, and you'd be all the way up these canyons and you could still hear the ocean like echoing through, because there was monster surf on the coast because of the storm up Northern California. The riding was good, you know, and they have bell boxes to distribute bells, and I didn't feel too much rider hiker conflict on a Sunday afternoon, which is good.
Right. And so then you went from there.
Avila Beach. Mm-hmm. And then I rode the Pismo Preserve. The principal fundraiser beneficiary of the Bovine Classic is the San Luis Obispo Land Conservancy, the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County.
Right.
And they own 60,000 acres in San Luis County. And they were... The beer ticket sales from the Bovine was, they were the beneficiary of those. So
oh, nice.
Quite a significant amount of money. And I talked to a gentleman there because it was of interest to me. I'm on the board of directors of the Escondido Creek Conservancy here in North County, San Diego. So
right.
I wanted to hear from those guys on how working with a bike event, because sometimes there's conflict with conserving land and cycling.
Right.
So I wanted to hear their take, and they said, oh, you got to go ride the Pismo Preserve on your way home. It's a great example of cycling, working with hiking cows, horseback riders, and the hotels.
Right.
So he gave me this pamphlet, and I'd seen it before. I knew about it because you'll be driving through Avila Beach or Shell Beach, Pismo, and you look up and you see people like riding high on the hill above the hotels there. You might remember McClintock's Steak Restaurant, which is now boarded up and gone, which is hard to believe, but it's sort of behind McClintock's there. And it's amazing. There's about 11-mile trail network. It's all super flowy under an oak grove, a coastal oak grove. So there's oak leaves that quiet your bike, provide shade, and you're overlooking Avila Beach, Pismo. They have bell boxes as well. They charge $5 to park, and that's a donation to the conservancy. So they maintain the bathrooms and the parking. And
right.
There's bell boxes. There's horse facilities there, so I don't know what day that happens.
Right. That might be good to know.
It's pretty small. You get a small, confined trail system. So, very flowy berms, very tight, can be very fast. I don't know how horses integrate in there too well, but there's horse facilities, a bathroom, and then there's like picnic tables throughout in the shade up high. And the hotels kicked in. The hotels are part of it. You can actually go on their website and get a discounted rate. It's an affiliate system where, the Land Conservancy is probably making a small cut of referring you to a hotel. But the hotels participated in it. You know, it's good tourism. It's kind of an amazing example of all the parties working together. There's one section where you actually ride up over some cattle guards into a cattle area. So it's not all open to cows, but there's one section that is. So the cattle ranchers are still have their cows with $1 million views.
Right. Well, that's good that they could work.
I'll send you guys the route because it sounds like you guys might get a chance to ride it. It's not open to e-bikes. And I looked and I go, well, is that pedal assist or whatever? And it just says no e-bikes.
Right.
And I guess that's matching San Luis County and how they manage their trail access on certain areas. So I don't think pedal assist is allowed. There's no e-bikes.
Right, no e-bikes. Yeah, we are going to be up there, actually back up in Napomo this weekend for a family function. And so I think on Saturday morning before we hit the first, actually got 2 days of stuff, but on Saturday morning, Kurt's driving down, I'm driving up, we're going to go hit that on our gravel bikes. I mean, if it's got, 10, 11 miles of loops, you can definitely, that's enough trail that you can go out and rip around and tie things together. The few videos and texts that you sent of it looked incredible. I mean, just like you were talking about, you have these nice trails going along on the side of the hill. You've got oaks over top, so it's a little bit shady, and you're looking out at this view down, and there's just surf and views and the ocean, and it looked great. It looks like definitely like the type of place you'd want to take a lunch and stop up there and hang out for a bit and enjoy the view.
Oh, for sure. For sure, there's picnic tables. I was there on a Monday. It wasn't too crowded. I only ran into maybe four or five other cyclists and a couple hikers. And the parking lot was only maybe half full. I did notice there's some free parking down closer to the hotels if you wanted to, but parking right there is convenient. So spectacular, and it's a good part of the bovine experience. Like, you can go up there and if you want a road ride in Cambria south of the landslide, maybe next year the road will be open. You got that. You can go to Montaña de Oro. You got the Pismo Preserve. And I know that there's other spectacular riding in the area, so it just pulls the whole experience together.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's great that you can, you get one trail system in and a couple of more, and then it makes it, just like you said, fun to go up there. And if you're doing an event, or you could just do a couple of days of riding, hit some new and different areas. So it sounds great. The Central Coast is awesome up there. It's really beautiful. So
you did some riding today. Did you ride anything different?
So I got in 2 days of riding. My ride schedule as of late hadn't been too filled, but I got out on my gravel bike yesterday and then my e-mountain bike today. And my gravel bike yesterday, I went out riding with Jonah and who's my main ride buddy, of course, and up here, and we got hit by some fall fog. So woke up yesterday morning and we were just socked in, and out on the deck. If I look out, I know if the deck is moist, then the dirt is going to be moist. And it's really great here on the front side, and where we ride up behind Summerlin, which is where we did our Pod 3 episode on all those trails. They are unbelievable right now. They're really good and worn in. And then the fog just tamped in and made the dirt so good. And we could tell, we rode up out of Summerlin. We meet at the Red Kettle Coffee Shop and then head up past the post office and wind up that hill. And as soon as you hit the dirt, you can just tell by the color of it. You're like, oh man, it's going to be a good day. And it was, so you could just do whatever you wanted on the dirt. So that was really fun. So I rode gravel yesterday, which was a blast. And then went out today on my e-mountain bike. I had an electrical problem actually on that I sourced out and fixed with Shimano customer service. Figured out where that was happening. So I hadn't ridden that bike in about 3 weeks. I didn't have the time to really dig into it. But it was really fun. So I went out today and just rode up and down. We did laps on Romero And Jonah, he got a loaner fork from the Wolf, our suspension guy, Lone Wolf Suspension. He's getting his fork warrantied, and so he loaned him this $1,600 push inverted fork. So Jonah, he was on that today. He actually said after the gravel ride yesterday, he picked up his bike, he went up and rolled Cold Spring, and he said the fork was so good compared to what he had that he just came flying down one of the first bumpy, rocky sections. He goes, and I got to the point of the corner and I pulled the brakes and realized there was just no way I was stopping. He was going so much faster, kind of flew off the edge of the trail, didn't get hurt or anything like that. But so that was fun today. And then another one of my buddies, Jim White, he ended up riding up and meeting us. We did some loops on Romero and he ended up meeting us for the last loop. We found him up there. So that was really fun. So I got to ride with the buddies and do some laps on Romero. So yeah, I got done with the E mountain bike ride today. And that was really fun. It was definitely loose up there, but the consistency of the dirt and how you slide it almost feels like skiing. Not that I'm a big skier, but to translate to people, it's like if you're on really fresh powder where you have, you know, good hold, but you can't push too hard. The dirt was slippery and you would kind of have traction today, but then it would go away pretty quick. There wasn't like a long sign off between having traction and not. You would be there and then the front end would go. So it definitely kept me on my toes, but I had some fresh brake pads in the rear. So everything was hitting. Yeah, that was a blast up on Romero. That's one of my favorite trails. I mean, we've been riding Romero. You've talked about the 7-Eleven guys, but you know, riding that in the late 80s, but we've been riding that, you and I and Kurt and our crew, since the early 80s on our original hardtails riding that trail. So I've seen it through, you know, and especially all the debris flow from, you know, about 8 years ago. And then all these last 2 years of rains, the trail is constantly changing. And they finally, SoCal Edison has finally fixed up the lower part of the fire road. For people who don't know, Romero has a fire road that goes all the way up to the top and then a single track that kind of cuts through. And a lot of people will either, you know, for people to hike, they'll hike up the single track and walk down the fire road. On a bike, you do the opposite. You ride up the fire road because it's a little bit mellower and then bomb the single track. And so that's what we did today. It's the first time I've ridden up the fire road, even halfway in 3 years it's been closed. So that was really fun to see and see all these old areas that we've known forever. And you always see how they change when you get back up there. That's one of the reasons I like riding on dirt. It always changes. You know, your same paved climb is always kind of the same. It just depends on how you're feeling on that day, but dirt's always changing. You know, there are a couple different slides, a couple different areas that come around the corner. You're like, oh, I got to go up and over this, you know, as there's some dirt that slid down, but that's kind of the fun of being out on the trail. Keeps it interesting for me.
Well, I think Romero is sort of holy ground for our mountain bike history.
Right.
You have a tire you designed that's named after it, correct?
Yeah, Panaracer Romero, designed for specifically those type of conditions, loose, slippery, rocky. Yeah, the Romero, that's right. Yeah, a long history in our mountain bike lineage. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. My next question was, what are you allowed to say what kind of tires are on your bike right now, or is there a conflict of interest?
No, I can say whatever's on mine. On my mountain bike, I've been testing, I've been going back and forth between testing the Continental Cryptotals, which, and I just buy them, so I'm not, you know, sponsored anything, but I got to say those tires are really great. They're downhill tires I run. You know, e-bike has a little bit more weight, and then our trails here have so much rock in them that for my weight, you know, I'm 192, 193 pounds, plus you throw, you know, a pack on and your helmet and stuff and water. Add that to the bike, it's pretty heavy, and like a medium, like an enduro casing for me, I'll end up, you know, cutting the sidewall on the rocks. So I have those downhill tires on. I'd been comparing those to when the Schwalbe radial tires came out, you know, kind of last winter. I have a set of wheels that's got those on them, so I've been going back and forth on those, and I just got a fresh set of Romeros that I'm going to throw on my wheels and go back out on there. So I've just been cycling my way through some different tires, you know, trying out the casings and compounds.
Is the Romero a front Panaracer tire, or is it a rear, or both?
It's both. You can run it on both. It's definitely. If we have two mountain bike tires for Panaracer. We have the Romero and the Aliso, and the Romero is more of the hard pack, drier condition tire. You know, the knob tops are a little bit bigger. They got a lot of feel to them, you know, because a hard pack tire, you're mostly riding up on the top of things. And then the Aliso is a little bit more of the wet weather tire. The knob tops are a little bit smaller, a little more open pattern, meant to dig in. But the Alisas around here, I really don't get to ride them until the winter time when we get some moisture in, because for our terrain, you know, they just dance around a little bit. When you have like an intermediate to softer condition tire and you ride it in the hard pack, it's not that it doesn't work, but it's not its optimal, you know, not its optimal area of performance. So I'm going to throw when I wear out the Cryptotols that are on my bike right now, which they got a little bit more life in them, I'm going to throw my Romeros on and go out and ride those and see how they're doing.
So my favorite preferred mechanic, Adam, at Cadence, he told me that he sees a lot of twists in mountain bike tires from Continental, like a lot of tire twists. And I said, really? I go, man, their road tires are like true as could be, and I don't find quality issues with them. But he's like, no, we're seeing a lot of twists. And so he kind of scared me away. I had purchased a Dubnatol 2.4 grip in the front, and the racing compound a little bit stiffer in the back.
Right.
He's like, I don't know, man. He's like, I wouldn't put those on. We're seeing a lot of twists. And so the tire I was taking off had a twist in it, so I didn't want to go from twist to twist.
Right.
So I ended up getting an air track, which is just basically the new version of whatever that tire was called before. It's not changing very much. But anyway, it was interesting to hear someone critical of Continental. I've always found them to be very reliable, consistent. And he was like, and I trust him, you know, that he sees the twist. He's not he doesn't make stuff. He's not a drama person. So
that
was interesting to hear him say that.
Yeah, that is. So it gets like what they call the snake belly, where the casing kind of gets that wobble in it. Yeah, I mean, maybe on those, because it's just a lighter casing tire. Like the Contis that I run on my mountain bike are obviously like a downhill casing. So you have more plies, a little bit more rubber, and I haven't had any problem with those. And I've worn like several sets of those out, and they've stayed straight and true. And the only Contis that I've had on my gravel bike, I had a set of 2.2 Race Kings. Now, interestingly enough, you know, I don't know if there's something in the Dubnatol, which is the newer version of the Race King. The Race Kings that I have on my bike, I've been riding the 50s, testing those out, or the 2.0s, I should say. And also I rode the front 2.2, actually front and rear 2.2, but admittedly, I didn't ride those that long. I wanted to get on the 2.0s. But I'll have to see, you know, the 2.0 Race Kings that I have on, I'm starting to get some decent amount of hours on them. And thus far, they seem straight. And I'm going to get around to those 2.2s a little bit later, my next kind of round of comparison testing. So I'll have to keep an eye on that and see if the casing, you know, starts to snake belly or not.
Yeah, in my size, I'm 200 pounds, so I might put I might be a twist creator, you know, at low PSI, I might create more twist in a tire than I realize. I don't know. I'm all new to mountain bikes, having been away from them for 30 years, to be honest. So I'll have to see how that goes. So the new AirTrak tire is amazing. I'm like, fresh rubber is a fresh good thing.
It's the biggest change just about you can put on your bike and really feel the difference. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about mountain bikes, and as you're getting into it, which I liked how you're just talking about the tech of mountain bikes, there's so much more now to focus on, right? Brakes and tires and different things that you were getting into the tuning of the bike. And that's one of the things I really love about riding on dirt, and what dirt brings is the surface is so much more varied that kind of your platform for optimal handling has to be a little bit wider. You know, because you just encounter more type of conditions out there. And that's a fun part of it for me too. Of course, you got suspension on a mountain bike and that makes a huge difference. And then you got your tires and your setup. And so finding that optimal setup for your rides is really a lot of fun. I really like that part of it. So I'm stoked that you're getting into it after I had been, you know, preaching the benefits of getting back on the mountain bike, although you pulled the trigger big time on your bike, which is pretty awesome. And by the way, how are you liking the flight attendant on your bike? Flight attendant suspension. Have you been getting it working?
Oh, it's a good question. Valid question. Yeah. I notice it's a very hot topic online. Like it's a very sticky topic for the socials. I would not like mountain bike riding as much without flight attendant. To me, that is part of the reason why that's the best bike I've ever owned in my life. It just I think maybe, you know, a person who's more versed at hitting the levers or twisting the grip or whatever to manage the dropper and all the things might not see flight attendant as a game changer as I do it, but I ride that by purely on the pleasure of flight attendant. Like it's one of my, you know, my Oprah favorite things. Like it's up there, you know. Like I think when Hydro Flask came out with, you know, insulated water bottles, I put that on my Oprah favorite things list. You know, right. Like certain things in life, you know, like an insulated cup.
Right.
Keeping the water colder longer is like, this is just like game changing. Like, and okay, granted, sometimes the power meter drops out and then the whole system goes down.
Right.
That's annoying. I'm like, why is the power meter dropping out and then it shuts off? Because it needs the power meter to know what's going on.
Right.
And I've changed the battery, so I need to go back and change the battery again. And I'm like, am I washing my bike improperly? Is it just dropping off because it's just dropping off and that's technology? You know, Quark is considered the best power meter, the most accurate. And so
right.
I'm a little surprised to see the dropout and that going down. It is annoying, but now I do know when the system is down. And by the way, it just leaves it in open, so it's not the end of the world.
You know, right. Like,
I think there's a lot of data now saying that locking out your bike is more for your mind than it is for performance. Like, you know, open suspension is not as slow as we think it is. Like,
right,
in moments where you think your mind thinks it needs to be locked out. So, anyway, you know, that is a little bit of a glitch. And I haven't played too much with the bias. You can go into the app and control the bias and turn it on
front,
more like
rear,
to lock
yeah.
it quicker.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I'm not that deep into it. It's taken me a lot of time to learn how to pressure my shock and suspension. You know, ChatGPT gave me its opinion. The original mechanic set it up with SRAM.
Uh-huh.
And I, you know, I asked ChatGPT specifically with this model fork and shock, what should it be? And so I've been going with ChatGPT's suggestion, which I'm sure is scouring the SRAM RockShox website.
Right,
you know, like,
right.
It's not like, it's not that smart, but anyway, I love it. I want you to ride it.
I know. I would love to get on something like that, because you could think in those minutes, you know, not, I mean, the fact that it's adjusting not only for your pedal input, but figuring out, you know, when you're hopping something, when you're loading into a turn, if it stiffens it and softens it. I mean, it sounds amazing. All the World Cup racing I watched, the guys that were on the flight attendant, definitely for short track and for XCO, their bikes looked great. I mean, they looked like they jumped well, looked like they never looked like it wasn't tuned as it was supposed to be.
Yeah, and here's an interesting thing. I love what's coming with my understanding. I love that my learning is going to just grow with this, but I learned something. Payson McKelvin pointed out something about flight attendant the other day,
uh-huh.
which made me think. He's like, you need to realize that it's not going to kick in till the first hit. So the shock has to go and then it's going to kick in. It doesn't have optics. It doesn't know that the
right.
first hit is coming in. So that's an interesting moment.
Hmm.
I mean, you can reach over and manually lock it if you know you're going to need it on that first hit, or you can ride
right.
into the first hit and then it kicks on, right? But that is the future of cycling is, like, honestly, we'll probably have some optical and it'll know that it needs to kick on before that first hit.
Right.
And I'm really getting into the weeds here, but hopefully you can understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that is the interesting part of it. And when you were talking about earlier about when to lock it out, when not to lock it out, you know, and some bikes have, you know, lock out both the fork and shock, some just lock out the fork. But the fact that you can just focus on riding and not have to worry about any of that and let the electronics take care of it is just a really cool development. I mean, you just want to, ideally, you're just wanting to focus on hitting your lines, railing your corners, up and over this, you know, doing it. And the suspension is figuring out what to do for you. That's amazing.
Yeah, and it would be exceptionally good in a racing situation. But for people who are not familiar, like I run into a lot of people who just don't know what it's like. There's a server, a servo, which right. is like going the whole time. So it's making hundreds of adjustments in a 10-minute period of time. So right. it's going on and off into, you know, the three modes that RockShox has of pedal, assist, and open. No, lock, pedal, and open. So it's going through those three modes.
Right.
And I imagine in the future we're going to have not three defined modes, but versions in between, like phases in between. So
yeah.
And I think it's coming for gravel. You know, as soon as gravel and braces, you know, front and rear suspension a little bit, I mean, I can't see how it doesn't come to gravel.
Yeah. I would think gravel is going to be forks. And then I'm kind of interested in seeing some smart suspension seat posts coming out. I think something about gravel for me, I know Trek came out with a full suspension gravel bike, but I wonder now, I haven't ever ridden a gravel bike with a fork on it, a suspension fork on it. I'm hoping to test something out sometime soon. But there is something to be said when you just have a lightweight, you know, fully rigid frame. Everything is connected. Now, for bumpy stuff, putting a fork on, just like when we used to have completely rigid bikes, remember the first time you put a suspension fork on your hardtail, you were like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, you can go right through things. And definitely there have been gravel rides I've got back where our gravel's pretty chunky that I can feel it up in my traps, you know, just from hitting bumps and going through. So I would love to try out a fork. The rear suspension, in terms of actual moving pivots on a gravel bike, I would be interested to see how that goes, you know, what the applications of it are. Now, I know like on the Mondraker Arid that I have, they use this kind of diamond flex technology in the rear stays. And by diamond, I mean, there's a shape of how the tubes come together. On their mountain bikes, they have that diamond kind of right behind the head tube and it helps it flex. So they've incorporated that into the rear seat stays. So it helps it go. And I can definitely feel that on the bike. And coupled with a good carbon post that just gets some flex to it, it's really, you know, it definitely takes the edge off. But I've been a big fan on my my Felt, which was an aluminum gravel bike, so a bit of a harsher ride. I had an old 1998, I think I got when I was sponsored by RockShox, their original suspension seat post. And I just love that thing. I've rode it all the time on there. I used to put them on my hardtails. I've had the same two and I've cycled them through for what is that, you know, 27 years now. But I haven't needed it on the Arid. And so I think that that's a real interesting part of where frame design goes, because something about, you know, the simplicity and of a rigid frame set and also durability over the long haul, you know, from being involved in mountain bikes, forks rarely have, yeah, about suspension on gravel bikes. It would just be, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. Like I said, I would really like to see a bit more of a smart suspension seat post coming out on the bike so that when you hit, you know, hit bumpy sections, you can unlock that. And it would be essentially like having some rear suspension on there, but you're really just looking to get relief between where the top of your seat is and the rear axle, you know, when you hit bumps. So I'll be interested to see where things go in the future with that.
Close. I would never have thought we needed rear suspension on gravel bikes until I rode my current XCO bike. I just think, oh, we probably do need rear suspension on gravel bikes as long as there's flight attendant to manage it. That's just how I see it.
Right, right. Yeah, well, we're going to be able to.
I don't think we need it without flight attendant, but if something is controlling it, I just can't see how it's not going to be faster. But
right, well.
When I'm sure SRAM Specialized and Giant and all that, they're all worried about it or thinking about it.
Right, right. I think that the benefits of suspension, you know, and when I think about some type of suspension on a gravel bike, I think that some of the benefits of having that suspension is just overall less fatigue to your muscles. Because, you know, when you drop into a bumpy section on a gravel bike, you know, you're going along playing and you kind of like hit stuff and you can almost feel the strain in your legs, especially if you're towards the bottom of the pedal stroke where you're extended and you kind of hit a bump. I know that those were some of the things that I really liked about having a suspension seat post like on my other bike. And one would think, especially for me, from having, as I dubbed, you know, coined my own term, my PSN, position sensitivity neuroses back in the day, you know, being so finicky about saddle height, I would have thought that that would have really bugged me, having a suspension seat post on my gravel bike. But after riding it for a few weeks, I didn't even notice it. And I actually think it's better when you go through those bumpy sections, because you come in instead of that shock going straight to your seat and through your body, it just mellows that shock out a little bit. And I think that that's an area that gravel bikes are, I just think that that's going to come around. I think for the very road oriented people, the idea of a suspension seat post, I think they freak out on the idea like, oh my God, my seat height is going to be going up and down. But like I said, from having, you know, the most sensitivity, probably like equal to as much as I've seen. And I adjusted to it pretty quick. So I haven't had any problems. So I'd like to see some major players start putting a little bit of effort into that.
Yeah, you know, Canyon did have its split leaf seat post. They have had it for years. It was a creep, mm-hmm. a creep master. I mean, because the two pieces of carbon would creep like crazy.
Right.
You know, and I noticed that Pete Stetna rotates that seat post in and out of his bike for different events. Redshift, the stem and seat post company, they have a... Redshift has a seat post that honestly looks like this right at the clamp, and it has an elastomer thing in it.
I've seen those.
Yeah, they also make a stem. Redshift does as well. I agree with you. And the dropper, I was watching Gravel Burn, which is, God, it's an amazing visual. Everyone should watch it on YouTube if they get a chance. It's basically Cape Epic. The guy who started Cape Epic made a gravel stage race that was, you know, let's just say seven stages. Had Pitcock and Matt Beers and Pete Stetna and on. And it was basically a Cape Epic production with camping and a helicopter
right.
and video and so forth. It's all over YouTube if you want to watch it. But I was watching those guys and I go, man, they look like they need a dropper sometimes on the descent, you know, like Milan San Remo.
Right.
You know, dropper seat post. I feel like dropper fits. I don't know. I guess my whole mountain bike experience is coming back to gravel, and I just look and I go, man, those guys could use a dropper on that descent. So
I it's interesting. I've never used a dropper on my gravel bike, but there's definitely times when, because we have some pretty steep gravel stuff, that for sure, if I could drop my seat even an inch, you know, 25 mils, it would definitely make a little difference of letting it float. I feel like on a drop bar bike, just because you have a drop bar bike and the way you fit on it, that a dropper isn't as required. I mean, on a mountain bike, you really can't ride without one. You know, if you're using a mountain bike to what it's supposed to be used for, even if you're on like a lightweight cross country bike. Now, Sam Gaze, who's, you know, a pro cross country racer on Alpecin, he would argue with me because he does not run a dropper on his bike, which I watch him and I'm just kind of like amazed that he runs a rigid seat post, but he's so tall and has such long legs. He just kind of hangs off the back of it. But for all the rest of us mere mortals and even the other pros, you know, the dropper is the way to go, you know, and a dropper would be different than a suspension seat post, two different things, right? The dropper is just getting the seat out of the way. The suspension seat post is actually just offering some shock absorption, some relief as you're riding. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I mean, that's a pretty easy piece of technology. And I think a rigid frame is just going to have a lot less problems, you know, no pivots, no creaking, no things like that. And so if you could maybe get that piece of technology just out of a seat post and ease up the overall ride, from the back end of the bike, the compliance, you know, and taking the edge off of hits, I think that would be a good way to go. So we'll see if any product developers out there for the suspension companies, you know, let's get on that.
Yeah. So today you tested out the new Shimano cleats?
Yes, I put those new Shimano Enduro cleats on, and they do everything.
You call them Enduro cleats. You call them
Enduro
cleats.
Well, you know. I thought you called them Enduro cleats. I think I'm following, but I haven't ridden them on my gravel bike yet. I was going to put them on, but just didn't have enough time on my gravel shoes. But I put them on, and they're great. I can attest to the fact that not only do they just feel like they snap in easier in general, but definitely I had times today where, you know, hang a foot because it was loose and dusty and put it on. And I knew I was right on top of the pedal, not like toed in and stepping down, and it made it in no problem. And it's definitely an easier, you can feel it kind of ramp its way into clicking in as opposed to feeling like you got to snap it in. There were no differences in terms of the release or anything I felt. I didn't have any problems like, say, you know, feeling like there was less tension. I left all the tension on my pedals the same. And they were great. So that's it. My trusty SMSH51 cleats that have been around for 30 years, they've been downgraded. So I'm on the new ones.
What's the new part number?
I don't have it memorized yet. It's like a TC something with a one. I can't remember exactly what it is.
Well, for our listeners, that looks like the front of the cleat is just slightly more bull-nosed or rounded down.
Yeah, just angled. The part that snaps in and under, instead of it being flat, it's just got an angle. And I think what that really helps with is the rear step in or the center step, and that ramp just helps it slide in and spread the retention system apart a little bit. But they do, they do what they say that they're supposed to do. So definitely those are going to be a permanent part of my riding from now on.
Well, this afternoon is moving fast, but I hope to put them on my own S-Fire shoes that I got from you that I'm going to try them out. I'm a little nervous. I've got some good coaching from you on how to mimic my, I'm going exact same shoe size, one same model, same shoe.
Right.
Clean that cleat. I'm going to get calipers out. I'm going to try and recreate the cleat position. I get nervous changing cleats.
Yeah, definitely. And then like I was talking about, just locate the visuals of how much gap and space there is on the side of the cleat. And even I gave one tip, if you can take like a piece of painter's tape or something, if you're looking at it visually and are trying to get that last, minute measurement, you can take a piece of like painter's tape and set it across and pick two, say, lugs on the sole, and set it across to make a line kind of up above, a visual line. And then you can adjust the cleat to that and move it. Yeah. And measuring from the tip of the cleat, with calipers up to, there's like a junction, on the shoe where it goes from the hard carbon and then the rubber starts. And those I've found with Shimano over the years are all pretty consistent. Their tolerances, coming out of their factories are pretty tight. So those are the tricks I've figured out, not only for myself, but for clients who would come in and have like, oh my God, I don't want to switch my cleats myself. I've been running this exact same setup for, 3 years and want to get them identical. And I find that the mountain bike cleats are a little easier to do that sometimes than the road cleats. Just from a visual standpoint, and then also if you're like, you're lucky in a way that you are, you have new shoes and new cleats, so you can keep your old setup looking exactly at it and then, and build up your new ones. The one thing I do like about the mountain bike cleats, talking Shimano, cause I run them on my road bike, although I don't really ride road much anymore, but from setting all those up, once you get the mountain bike cleats to seed in, they have just like a few little knurly grippers on the bottom of the metal and they make a nice set of grooves. So like my shoes this morning, I just pulled the old cleats right off and just stuck the new cleats right on. And if you just wiggled them, they just dropped right into the old, those old little stepped in parts from those feet on the cleat. And that was really easy to switch. And so for you, obviously setting it up, you got to kind of compare to where the cleat is centered on the slots that slide back and forth where they go into. But those are the tricks from back in the day.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, unless it's got more to add, I think that kind of wraps up episode 11, part 1 and 2.
Yeah, part 1 and 2.
We appreciate the likes, the comments. They all help us and, other cycling-minded people find our content and be suggested to watch. So the likes, the comments, the feedback are appreciated, and we're always looking for sponsors. So
yes, absolutely. Okay, and, thanks, everybody.
We'll be back with Kurt on another episode soon.
Okay.
Take care.